Today I will be talking about the boundary of clusters, and I will be presenting some work that I have done with other people. You can see them all down here. It's mainly other people in Leiden. Can you see my pointer?
Yeah, I see it.
Perfect. So yeah, with other people in Leiden about this topic. So I work in Leiden, as Neil has just said, which is a little town, a very quaint town in the Netherlands. And of course, like every good Dutch town, we have our own windmill and our own cheese farm. The cheese here, we don't call it Gouda, we call it Gouda, but it's the same, it's Gouda. And so Leiden, it's a small town between The Hague and Amsterdam. It's very nice. And me myself personally, I work at these two institutes. One is the Lorentz Institute for Theoretical Physics, and one is the Leiden Observatory. During these talks, I usually like to show a photo of my workplace, and I wish it was this nice observatory that you can see down here, but actually we work in this very gray office building out of town. I think it's still a nice indication of where I am. Well, so I guess if I were to be honest, nowadays I would show a photo of my couch, but that wouldn't be very very appropriate. So let's move on with the talk. So the boundary of clusters. The way I planned this seminar was to have an initial part, maybe the first half, where we'll be presenting the definition of a boundary of a cluster and the physics that define it. And after this, maybe 5 minutes to get some questions from the audience to see if there are any doubts about this. In general, I'm not sure if everybody's muted or not, or if you can unmute yourselves. If that's the case, feel free to ask small questions. For any big questions, it's better to wait until the end of the talk, or at least until the end of this first section. So let's start. So structure in the universe arises from this starting point, which is this homogeneous field of dark matter, and the small perturbations inside it grow over time until we form this cosmic web, as you can see here. At the nodes of the cosmic web sit what we call fully collapsed structures, or halos. Over time, these halos grow because they accrete matter. There's two modes of accretion, roughly speaking. One, it's mergers. And for example, here in this snapshot from a numerical simulation of cosmological evolutions, you can see this big guy here is in the process of being eaten by this, small guy here is in the process of being eaten by this big guy here. These are massive structures of the size of tens of megaparsecs. And these big daddios of the universe, we call them galaxy clusters because they host multiple galaxies. So this is the first method of growth, mergers, but there's also a more subtle way, which is through smooth accretion. So diffuse material that you can see in this image as this violet purple haze. So this smooth material is constantly infalling into the central object here. So the simplest way to study this process of growth, it's called spherical collapse. And it's a very simple setup. You consider, we consider a small perturbation, an overdensity. We center around it. And in an expanding universe, following the Hubble law, material surrounding this center over density will be expanding away from it. We set this as an initial condition, and in a spherically symmetric setup, you can see there's a center over density and material around it. Initial velocity proportional to its distance from the center over density. The dynamics of this setup are very boring. There's only one scale, which is this turnaround scale, which is the moment when the shell reaches its maximum extension and then collapses back into the overdensity. This is, of course, a periodic motion. There's nothing that should change that, and so it keeps going forever. This is a very boring setup. I'm glad the universe doesn't work this way. Thankfully for us, the universe is more complicated, but it's also harder to model. So let's consider now an infinite amount of shells, all distributed around the central over density. And in the next simulation, I will be showing I will be showing only two shells, but imagine there's an infinite amount of them surrounding the central over density. So the two of them start as slightly different radii, hence slightly different velocities, and one collapses before the other. If we wait until we start again of the thing. So the blue shell collapses first, the red one collapses afterwards, and then they trade places where one is inside the other and then vice versa. This phenomenon is called shell crossing, and that's what makes all of this dynamics complicated. And one effect of this shell crossing, which I want to highlight, is the fact that over time, the shells go deeper and deeper into the overdensity. That is because if, for example, you consider the blue shell, at this point in time, the blue shell is feeling some extra mass inside of it. The red shell, which was before outside of it, then appears to be inside of it. So from outside, the red shell goes inside. So it does bring an additional force and carries the mass of the blue shell deeper and deeper into the halo. This process keeps going because there's an infinite amount of shells surrounding this overdensity, and they all keep piling up towards the center. A nice way to see this is to look at the phase space distribution in a given instant. So in this image here, I'm showing the distribution in radial position and radial velocity of all of the shells of which only two I was plotting before. And these shells roughly can be divided into two regimes. One, it's these ones here. As you can see, these shells have negative velocity and are a large radii, meaning they are infalling now towards the central overdensity. On the other end, material here is orbiting the halo. I want to highlight, I want to stress this because that's important. These lines here are not trajectories. These lines, for every point in these lines, you can interpret it as a shell surrounding the overdensity. The boundary between these two regimes I just described is this caustic. It's a phase space caustic because it's a position, it's a radius at which multiple streams cross. So you have both material which is coming out and material which is coming in. And this caustic is named splashback and defines a radius that really neatly separates these two regimes, orbiting matter and infalling matter. And this is what we call the halo boundary. It is very neat, but what makes it even cooler, for me at least, is that not only this is a feature in phase space, which is very abstract and not easy to probe, but it's also a feature in the actual density profile. So if we look at how the mass is distributed for these shells, we see that there is a sudden drop in correspondence to this caustic. And this sudden drop, you can understand it as the fact that inside of it, material is piling up, right? It's orbiting and it's still there. While outside of it, it's always new material which is coming. So it's not as abundant. Yeah. So the first people who highlighted this feature are Dimmer and Kratzoff in this paper from 2012, where they looked at the density profiles of relatively high mass halos. And what they saw was that when stacking them, the average profile had a position which is roughly the zero radius, which I will define later. At roughly this position, there is a deviation from this, from a traditional NFW profile. And this you can see in the density profile. A very clear way to see this is also in the logarithmic slope of the profile. So this is, if you want, the slope in log-log space. And so there is a specific radius where there is this departure. When looking at very high mass halos, this is even clearer. So first, what they have seen is that these halos stack better. So the shaded area here shows the average, the variance of the mean. So it's lower, it means that clusters are more self-similar, but also that these departures from the expectation, it's sharper. So this logarithmic slope of -4 really tells you that you have a sudden drop. If you want, sometimes this is called an edge because it's a sharp transition from everything to nothing. And so high mass halos are a nice target for this. In this context, high mass halos means everything above the cluster scale. So for people who know, about 10 to the 14 solar masses.
So it really seems that in low mass halos, there's no sudden drop off at all in the sense that it doesn't go below the iNASTO profile. So would you, you say there's no splashback there? And if so, then why not?
It's a bit semantic, right? So if you define splashback as this departure from NFW, then no. It's only because I think it's due to the stacking and it's due to the fact that it's not as a clear sharp drop for low mass halos. To me, that I see splashback as a phase space feature. Of course it does exist. This boundary always exists and it is always in correspondence to this minimum. So it depends on your point of view, I guess. To me, detecting splashback as this sudden drop, it's a bit of a moot point. We know that in lambda CDM this happens. So it looks like this in one case and like this in another case, but that's it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, so. So, okay, you have a boundary of a halo. That's very interesting, Omar, but we have so many scales, so many radii associated to halos. Do you need another one? How many extra ones can you possibly create? And in particular, I want to mention one which is maybe it's trivial for people who work on this topic, why this is not relevant, but the profile of dark matter halos up until 20 years ago in simulations was very well fitted by a simple broken power law, meaning this is like a profile which has a slope of -1 and a slope of -3 and large radii. And there's a scale radius where there is this transition. Now, this scale radius, it's true. It's something typical of halos. Unfortunately, it's not defined as a boundary. And the NFW, it's just a vacuolaire profile. It's an equilibrium profile for a collisionless fluid, which is isolated. And it's powerful, but it turns out that this scale radius is really telling you something about when the halo was formed, and it doesn't really tell you much about how big a halo is. So this is not very interesting for the purposes of a halo boundary. The natural, and up until 5 years ago, definition of a halo boundary was the Vero radius. And this is my one slide cartoon explanation of a Vero radius. And the calculation goes more or less as follows. You study a top head distribution and its cosmological, its evolution over cosmic time. So something which is top head will evolve into something more cuspy due to self-gravity. And then in this system, you assume that eventually we'll reach equilibrium. And then you impose the Vero relation, which it's like this relation for isolated systems that stay isolated, where the gravitational energy and the kinetic energy of the particles are related to each other. The Vero radius results in something that in cosmology we call these overdensity radii. And here I have an example of this. So a proxy of a Vero radius is this R200m, and it can be defined as the radius within which the mass inside it is 200 times the average density of the universe, the average matter density of the universe. It turns out that this result is a prediction of this initial spherical collapse calculations. And it's always been a very good measure. It's why we have constructed halo mass functions and how we even test cosmology using clusters to this day. Now, let's try and compare now in these figures. Now, what I want to do is to compare two halos, which in principle have the same Vero mass, but as you will see, have very different boundaries and very different shapes. And this is not captured by the Vero radius. So here I'm showing two halos, which have slightly different gamma. This gamma is a measure of how fast these halos are growing. It's called mass accretion rate. And as you can see, they look very different, right? This is very concentrated. This is less concentrated. But both of them, if you look at large enough scales, have a clear boundary. Beyond this, there's obviously no material belonging to the cluster, but inside of it, everything belongs to the cluster. And if you were to see this in an animation, it would be even more clear. So if we look at the Vero radius of the R200m, actually, here what I'm plotting is R200m. In one case, it really captures this boundary of halo, but in another case, it doesn't do such a good job. It's really failing. However, when you look at the splashback radius defined as this caustic, and in this case, in fact, from the density distribution, you can see that it's clearly capturing the boundary of a halo, right? Even if a Vero radius couldn't. So this is, again, if you wanna see the comparison, you should be looking at the dot dashed line and the dashed line. So what this tells us is that the boundary of halos is not just the Vero radius, but it's something more complicated. So the Vero calculation, I think it's a great result, but if you want, it's also a trivial statement, right? The connection between the Vero radius and the Vero mass is just a simple overdensity relation. It's not really capturing the physics of it, if not in an average way through this Vero relation. And its biggest problem, if you want, is that it assumes equilibrium, while as we have seen, these halos are growing over time. So now we'll talk about some results which I have not published yet. So take them from what for what they are. But the way I see Splashback is not as an alternative to these video relations, but it's an improvement of them. It's telling you that a second order, your video relation is not capturing the boundary, but you need to add some dependence on the accretion rate. And this is what I'm trying to do here. So in fact, by looking at simulations of these high mass clusters, you can see that the mass within the splashback radius and the splashback radius itself form a scaling relation, a very reasonably tight scaling relation, which is just a perturbation of the video one. And in fact, this form can be explained through the simple models that I have used before for spherical collapse. But now the question is, what decides this gamma, this accretion rate? Well, we have seen it before. It's a structure surrounding the halo. And so in particular, you can see all these filaments flowing into the central node. So what I did in these simulations was to try and look at how the profile looks inside of the filaments and outside of the filaments. And we see something interesting. So the fact that this minimum is located at different positions confirms that, if you want, natural idea that along filaments, more stuff is accreting. The accretion is faster. There's more material falling in. But what this shows also, which maybe was lost until now, is that the profile outside the large radii is also affected. So what this plot is telling me is that a radii much further away from R200M, material looks like a power law, roughly a power law, and its slope, its index, depends on the accretion rate. And actually, this is true. If we look at the distribution of substructure outside of splashback and its power law index, it's really correlated to the accretion rate. What's really maybe deeper about this statement, though, is that while with self-similar spherical models, we can capture the dependence of this point, of this minimum with accretion rate, the self-models, the self-similar models, do not capture at all the dependence of the outer material. So if you want, you can say that the accretion rate is shaping the size of your halo, but what I think it's more fair is to say that the material, the environment of a cluster, the filaments surrounding the cluster, are really telling you where its boundary is. And I think now it's a good time to do this pause. Here I have like this fun image where my partner asked me to look at something one day, and he had seen the splashback appears actually on the IKEA website. I think it's only a mistranslation of backsplash, but it's always funny to see like what you're working on the real world. So I thought I might show it here. So are there any questions up to this point about the dynamics of splashback?
Sure. Like, so on the previous slide, by self-similar, what exactly did you mean?
Here?
Yeah.
So if you want, it's not just a matter of the accretion rate is not just one parameter that belongs to the halo. It's just a way to parameterize the structure surrounding the halo.
Well, okay. So like, you know, so by self-similar, I would think of something like the Fillmore and Goldreich kind of model. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very tight relationship between, you know, the accretion rate onto the structure and, you know, and the profile outside the structure.
Yeah. So if you, I could plot
you draw like a line, a horizontal line.
No, absolutely not. But actually it's like this. So it's like 3 gamma divided 3 plus gamma minus 3, I believe. Yeah, I did do this exercise. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So the boundary condition at turnaround really tells you how the profile looks at large scales, but it's really not describing this at all. Does that make sense?
I still don't know what you mean by this blue band.
So this, if you want, just immediately after splashback, you get a band. So it's true you don't get a turnaround, but if you look at immediately after the caustic, it's mostly constant.
Okay, yeah. Please.
Yeah, so it's true a turnaround, you have a tight relation, which is anyway completely wrong because it goes, like it has a different, it's not, yeah, it has a different derivative. But even if I were to use it, it would just be even longer.
Well, yeah, like perhaps you're not plotting, I guess, the same thing as what I'm thinking of, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, we can talk about this later, maybe. But are there any questions? Any other questions? Okay. Perfect. So let's move on. So in the second part of the talk, I wanna discuss how we can actually measure this feature and how we do it. Actually, we do it constantly nowadays. It's really, it's not new. It hasn't become observationally viable in the past few years, but it's only been possible thanks to some modern technological advancements, in particular in with large surveys like SDSS and everything bigger than that. So the objects we want to look at are these galaxy clusters, which are these biggest halos in the universe, and they are a collection of galaxies. So one way that you can do this measurement of splashback, it's to look at the galaxy distribution around a center, optimally defined. So the idea behind this measurement is to consider galaxies as test particles moving inside a potential. And so ideally they track the density profile that I described before. This measurement requires a lot of objects, a freaking ton of objects. And as I said, it's only been possible thanks to modern surveys. This assumption of the galaxies tracing the dark matter halo is not completely correct. And what makes it maybe less powerful is the fact that no matter what the dark matter profile will look like, the galaxies will always show a splashback feature simply because they're infalling into something. I think it's been established without any doubt that dark matter halos are gravitational potentials. Even if we don't know what the dark matter is. So the galaxies will always have this feature by moving inside the density profile. So it's been very powerful. It provides the best constraints, but it needs some more interpretation. A second way, which is what I've been working on, it's actually by looking at the weak lensing signal. If we look at galaxies far away from the cluster, here the red objects are galaxies inside the cluster, or the more bluish ones are galaxies in the background. As you can see, some of them are deformed, and this is lensing shear. This is called gravitational lensing. And by looking at the average deformation of these galaxies, we can really extract a direct measure of the mass of this object. Unfortunately, it's a very hard measurement to do. It requires a lot of time, and it doesn't offer the most precise constraint. The third way, which it's lost maybe on most people, but I think it's been very cool, is to look at the velocity of these galaxies. As I said, the splashback is a feature in phase space. It is not a feature in, it's not only in real space. So by looking at the velocity dispersion of objects along the line of sight, you can really get this extra information. Unfortunately, spectroscopic data is the most expensive of the one I just mentioned, among the ones I just mentioned, and it's only feasible in really, really large spectroscopic surveys which measure a lot of galaxies per cluster. So I'm thinking DESI, I'm thinking BOSS, for people who know what I'm talking about. Nice. So I wanna show just to flash it because it's cool and I think it's nice. One measurement that we have performed, it is not on a survey, it is on a small survey of 27 massive clusters, this CCCP, Canadian Cluster Comparison Project, very funny name. And so we have performed this measure. It turns out that there's a completely different set of systematics compared to the usual mass measurement, because we're pushing a very large radii where that's not where most of the mass in clusters is. So you really have to be careful about that. After you are, you get something that agrees with simulations. What we found that's very interesting is the fact that even if we halve our sample, so if we take only 13 objects, you also can constrain the position of the splashback. And you get a similar uncertainty. You don't get to see a deviation from an NFW, perhaps, not a strong deviation from an NFW, but you can constrain this radius nonetheless. At the moment, we have an uncertainty of 25%, but we're planning to collect more data on this. So now, I told you there's this splashback, I told you we can measure it, but I haven't told you what can we do with it. So we can measure, but what do we test with these measurements? And I wanna flash just some results, two of them by Neil here, your Neil, Dahl, and then I'll show one by me. I'll expand more on that. The first result here, it's related to self-interacting dark matter. So if you treat the dark matter as the opposite of a collisionless fluid, as an interacting fluid, this of course will affect its density profile. And in this plot, they show like this usual logarithmic slope as a function of radius. And you can see that in these models, I think black is lambda CDM or a cold dark matter, and green is the one with the highest interaction. You can see that there is a deviation. And hopefully this will be measurable by future surveys. The second one, there's a bit of overlap of the authors here. It's instead based on beyond GR models. Here, again, they used numerical simulations to see how this slope changes as a function of radius. And so here, in black is a GR, you can barely see it. And in blue is F of R 10 to the minus 5, which is a famous model of F of R. So it's a modification of gravity scalar tensor theory for which there are simulations. And you can see there is some departure. My paper instead had a slightly different approach, which was based on looking at viscostic in phase space. So trying to explore the trajectories of particles inside of a halo and see how they are modified under changes to gravity. This is a semi-analytical model. It's not based on full numerical simulations because it's faster and it gives you some control of the theory parameters. So we picked this theory, this symmetron theory of gravity. It's a usual scalar tensor theory of gravity where you have this very nice symmetry. And like every scalar tensor theory of gravity, you have matter, which couples to a conformal transformation of a metric felt by a new scalar field. So this is in the Jordan frame, so you can use your normal Einstein equations to describe it. What makes it maybe interesting, this kind of model, is that but it's a couple of years now, Claire Burridge and Edmund Copeland have shown that this treatment is equivalent to a Higgs portal dark matter alternative, which is similar to a model of bosonic dark matter, which is which makes it maybe interesting beyond the alternative to GR crowd. So in these models, it's very simple. In high matter density areas, so dense regimes like could be the Earth, but also galaxies in some cases, and in the early universe, the VEV of this field is just zero. And because you can treat its interaction with matter with its with this effective Lagrangian, you just kill every interaction. So you kill any additional fifth force that this field might carry. In low matter density areas instead, you get this extra force, this extra fifth force, because the VEV is different from zero. In the symmetry model, you see that the force, it's killed in high density areas by having a VEV which is zero. So everything in between high density and low density has a gradient in phi. And the gradient in phi, of course, translates in an additional force profile. Now, Splashback is particularly suited to explore these kind of mechanisms, this kind of fifth forces, because, well, it is by definition a sharp transition in the density profile. And so you have a very efficient force at these distances, which hopefully should change your dynamics. And indeed it does. So this is, in this slide, I show the results of this semi-analytical model. It's a very colorful plot. I'll try to guide you through it. So on the y-axis, the first thing I want to highlight maybe, it's I show the fractional change in splashback radius. And this is of the order of 10%. So this is great because this is already within present day constraints of this feature.
So this little f of like one, for example, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, does that correspond to like gravity being like?
Yeah, right? Actually, there's a factor. I think there's a factor five between. Yeah, I should have renormalized this. So it's like a fifth of GR. One, it's a fifth of GR. Yeah.
Gravity. Wait, sorry. So little f of one means that the gravitational force is one fifth as strong as.
Sorry, no, it's one fifth extra. So this is the strength of the fifth force in addition to GR.
Okay, so six fifths of GR.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I should renormalize this. I always think about that, but I never. Yeah.
Okay, I see. Okay, great. And it scales just like linearly in this f.
More or less, yes. At these positions, which are actually what's unconstrained, yes, it does.
No, I mean like the deviation from gravity. The deviation from GR.
Yeah. So if you want, you can say what's the force of a point mass. Yes. So this scales nicely that way.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
And so, of course, because splashback, it's an integrated effect, though this doesn't necessarily translate into a linear effect in splashback, even if it's, I mean, you can see it, it behaves nicely. So, of course, if you increase the force, you get more change. That's not surprising. You're just changing the force felt by these particles.
But can you also remind me, in the Symmetron model, is there something like a Weinstein mechanism, you know, such that gravity is like normal
it's
GR.
A symmetry mechanism, yeah. Yeah, it's exactly something similar, yes. So so if you want the force here is zero here and zero here, you can consider it as, so you get a field profile, which is very similar to what you would have in a chameleon profile, yeah. So the only difference with a chameleon is that in the chameleon, you're killing the mass. So you're ending it, you're killing the interaction by increasing or lowering the mass, while here you're changing the VEV. But by looking at the field profile, it looks very similar. Mm-hmm. Does that answer you?
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you.
Cool. So this is it. And change force. But then there's this other effect, which I think it's the coolest part about this, is the fact that there's a timing scale inside these models, which is the spontaneous symmetry breaking scale when the fifth force kicks in. As we said, in high density regions, this force is screened. This applies also to the early universe. And if you want, there's a certain redshift at which you started. And what happens is that if you start your force too soon, and then your entire halo is screened, so it doesn't feel a fifth force, so you're not affecting things much. While if you started too late, the material splashback has already collapsed, has already reached its point, and so you're not feeling it. And what you see here is that there's an optimal time at which you have to start this, this force, which matches nicely with what you would expect to explain dark energy with these models. So it's roughly a redshift one, and it's really matching this parameter space. So it's a nice connection between this physics of nonlinear structures and these models of gravity, which can also explain dark energy. So this is just to make clear. So I get this a lot during talks. I don't necessarily believe that GR is wrong. I don't necessarily believe that lambda could not be an explanation of the acceleration of the universe. This is just to test. This model was just a way for me to test what can we explore with splashback? What physics is it probing? Of course, these are fair questions, and these are perfect models to be tested with this probe. Another criticism that I get often is, oh, but you do modify gravity, but like you can just blame everything on baryonic physics that you don't understand. And so I did look at this. I said, oh, but can baryonic physics affect this feature? And here I show you two simulations of the same halo, the same cluster, in hydrodynamical and in dark matter simulations. And I'm not sure if it's too clear here, but there is this smaller halo, which is in the process of being eaten by this big halo. And this small halo, it's located at a slightly different radius. This is because it's been affected by feedback processes, which are like this big problem in modeling of galaxy formation. And even if for the individual halo, there could be these subtle changes, when looking at the average, at the mean profile of these, of a suite of around two dozens of simulations, you see really no differences in the profiles between the two. So no, I do not expect splashback to be affected by baryonic physics. And this is great. It makes it such a neat probe for self-interacting dark matter, but also for beyond GR models. This concludes my talk. I want to just quickly talk about my future endeavors to really put strong constraints on this modified theories of gravity. I have IMPI of a big observational survey of around 40 high mass clusters. So the squares in this redshift mass space are the clusters I have been observing for the past 2 years. And just for comparison, DES clusters sit mostly here. So here we're talking about almost an order of magnitude, maybe a factor five higher. So we hope maybe before the end of my PhD, which is in 11 months, to produce these constraints. The expectation is a 4 sigma detection or splashback with a 10% uncertainty. I think my time is over. I'll just leave you with this summary slide, and thank you for coming. Yeah, I hope I convinced you the boundaries of halos, and the cosmic web shapes these boundaries, and that this is a cool new probe. It's up and coming. There's a lot more data that will arrive soon. Stay tuned. Thank you for your time.
Okay, great. Thanks, Omar. Here, so this just applaud, I guess, like virtually or also audibly. Okay. Any further questions for Omar? People can feel free to unmute themselves, or you can raise your hand and wait to be called on. Either way is fine. Maybe I can start. Let's see. So, so you mentioned this upcoming, program, mm-hmm. using future data. So, how will this compare, though, to the constraints that we already have from Dark Energy Survey?
Yeah. So it will be a bit worse, but it's another mass regime. So I think both of them are complementary because by different masses probe different parameter spaces. It's complementary.
Oh, okay, so is that shown here? You're saying so your sample is somewhat higher mass. It looks like
yeah, it's a factor 5 at least to what you can see with DS. This is because high mass clusters are very rare in the universe. So with a survey, you're not catching them. You have to look for them, to hunt them.
But Dark Energy Survey, I guess, also has these papers where they were stacking on clusters selected from ACT or from SPT, right?
Yep. But because it's just a matter of area and depth. Here we are surveying, it's like a survey of the whole sky. That's the only thing that can give you this many high mass clusters.
Oh, okay. So your sample, you're saying for the high mass, SZ clusters, your sample will be even larger than the ACT SPT sample?
For high masses, yes. So of course, because the mass function is exponential, you will always have freaking ton of low mass halos. Yeah. So there we cannot compete with targeted observations. By high mass, this is the only way to do it.
Okay, cool. Any further questions? Okay, so if not, let's thank Omar again.